Welcome to season 10 of Talking with Traders as we begin 2025. We're into the fifth year of this podcast that began in 2020, and we've just surpassed 200,000 downloads of Talking with Traders. Once again, IG have come on board as the sponsor of this podcast. We're truly grateful to have such a global leader in online trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we welcome back to the show, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from players in various areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Or, if you watch these interviews on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a thumbs up and leave a comment if you wish. We welcome the engagement. Once again, thank you to IG for sponsoring this podcast into its fifth year, and thank you, listeners, for your continued support. Now, let's get into this week's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Talking with Traders. And this week, it's my great pleasure to introduce another podcast host. His name is Colm Murphy. He's the host of the Unpacking the Markets podcast, something that I once appeared on, which was very kind of you, Colm, to ask me onto your podcast. And having discovered your podcast, I've then listened to many of them, and you've actually had a number of great interviews, some really, really good guests, and a lovely style of interviewing. So congratulations on that. Your podcast looks like it's doing well. It's getting a lot of followers on YouTube. So congrats on that. And welcome to this podcast.
You know, it's an absolute pleasure. And that's super high praise coming from you, Gareth, because obviously your podcast is one of the leading podcasts in the UK. So to be here and for you to have been a podcast guest for me, it's a super moment. So thank you for that.
Great. Well, I love cross-pollinating with other podcasters and having conversations. So I'm looking forward to chatting to you. But as I do with every other guest that comes onto this podcast, I always like to go back a little bit to the beginning and tell me your story. I mean, I know you're quite young. You said to me off air, you're 28 years old, so you're still a youngster with a very bright future ahead of you. But give us a bit of background. What got you involved in trading? What do you trade? And I suppose, yeah, what was the appeal to start your own trading podcast?
I think I've always had that kind of fascination with financial markets. I think when I was 14, 15, it was just seeing something go up in value in a market and some people knew why it went up in value. I just found that amazing for some reason. I don't fully understand why, but, and then I ended up buying, you know, the Intelligent Investor when I was, I think, 16, and did a night course when I was 17, and I just loved it. And then I was far too sensible to follow that passion when I was in university and I did an IT degree. So, but then fast forward to when I moved to London, I just felt like it was time to really give this a go and actually do it as opposed to just learn about it. And that was about 3.5 years ago. So that was when I kind of started my, I like to think, the practical trading journey, not just the learning about and watching markets. Yeah. And then, yeah, I started the podcast a year ago. Just because, I mean, I wanted to expand into the kind of trading network and see how other people did it and ask, I hope, pretty simple questions about how people make money in markets. And I've learned a lot doing it. Yeah.
I'm sure you have. I mean, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts. You ask good questions and get good answers. So that's always the right idea, I suppose. I mean, I know you're not a full-time trader. We're not going to talk about this too much because I know you are somewhat restricted, but you do have a full-time job, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. And so trading is not your full-time income source. It's kind of a side hustle for you at this stage in your career. So we're not going to go into the job side of things too much, but do you find actually that having a full-time job is a healthy distraction in terms of your trading? And the reason I ask this is because I think if you've got the ability to sit in front of the screen all day, which is what many people want, right, if they're trading, but But I've often thought if you're sitting in front of the screen the whole day, that can also become a little bit addictive, and sometimes it can encourage overtrading. So in a way, having a healthy distraction might be a good thing. Do you find that as well, or am I wrong?
Yeah, I think definitely it has an impact on me. I think if you talked to me 3 years ago, it would have been probably the most destructive thing that could happen to me when you're new is sitting in front of a screen all day. But even today, I think one thing that catches my sometimes is data releases. And if you get caught watching the pandemonium that is when we have a non-farm payrolls number and price goes crazy on equity indices or your dollar or whatever, very easy to get drawn into that and start to see things, you know, especially when you've got a chart in front of you and all your biases, you start to think, you know, Da Vinci Code is coming together and you see something and then you just lose your money, you know. So I think that part I would definitely struggle with. But these days, I mean, the process I've kind of created has been a bit around my job. It's not something I can, you know, with a job, as you know, you can't be sitting in front of that screen. So I think my process has naturally developed to be something that I do in my 5 to 9 or in the kind of 2 hours before 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. when I start work. And for me, it had to be manageable that way because that's my life. And then that's really what ended up working for me. And so I've stuck with it. So I'm hoping that I wouldn't become some kind of intraday scalper if I went full time with trading. Right now, it takes me about maybe an hour a day, 2 hours a day, plus keeping up with what's happening, to just maintain it. So I think it's very doable with the job. But I'd probably need something to keep me busy during the day. I'd go a bit mad.
Absolutely. And what do you trade, actually? We didn't touch on that.
Usually FX futures and more recently CFDs under these FTMO type prop accounts,
So
right?
these are these funded accounts, right? Where
Yes.
they pay you, they give you the ability to take some leverage, and if you do well, they actually pay you out percentage of your profits.
That's right. Yeah, but you're not actually trading, right? The whole thing is like a casino game, basically, but it's based around markets. But none of your orders are actually hitting an exchange. It's not like real trading. I think some might be, but it's a bit more of an illusion than that. It's kind of all in a virtual environment. It's a like trading, but I see it more as a kind of not a long-term play, but something that lets you take risk when you have quite a lot of restrictions, as I do, unfortunately.
It's good to hear that, though, because I mean, I know a lot of these funding firms, you hear different things about them. I'd say, on balance, most of what I've heard about them is actually not that great. Many of them seem to, have this reputation for almost wanting their traders to lose money because they can take the other side of the bet, and that means they're making money if their traders are losing money and all that. So actually, if you're doing well and they are paying you out, that's good to hear.
I mean, I completely agree with that. It's buyer beware. I mean, it's a bit like crypto exchanges. How many of them do you need to go down for you to realize this is not the long-term game? But I think the big ones, people like FTMO, who have verified, you know, millions of dollars of payouts and aren't stuck for the cash that you need to get paid out, can be as safe a bet as you can make in a risky business.
Oh, it's good to hear. And you've mentioned then that your approach to trading, it has had to kind of be built around your life, which makes sense. You obviously have a full-time job, so you therefore don't have all day to sit in front of the screen to watch everything. And you've mentioned that you have sort of an hour or two per day to do your research. And I certainly think that in my own trading, I also find that that probably is enough time, actually. I mean, I have more time than that, but reality is you can build a trading process that only requires you to work, an hour or two per day. It's about finding that style that fits your personality and fits with your lifestyle. But I want to talk a little bit about that. So what, give us some ideas of, what analysis techniques you use to identify trades. What kind of what boxes need to be ticked in order for you to initiate a trade? Let's put it that way.
So my kind of analysis, I think, goes on two levels, right? One is about context and market market reactions, and usually those market reactions are to big news or data releases.
Right.
Context is the world of like macro and geopolitics, which is kind of where I started and fell in love with and got so lost in, and then you just lose money, right? Because macro on its own is completely useless. I think it's great when when people want to smart, sound quite intelligent, and a lot of people do, or people that are on Bloomberg talking about it. But one thing I've realized about macro is that it's just to understand what's going on right now, right? And on its own, it's really kind of got nothing. But when you combine it with a price reaction, as in we have non-farm payrolls and the USD across a number of pairs reacts in a certain way, those two things together give me a bias basically on the USD, or they give me a bias on US equities or risk assets. But say if it was risk assets as a whole, that could be, gold, for example, as a risk off asset, equities as a risk on asset, dollar yen as a risk on asset, et cetera, right? So you kind of context plus price reaction plus how things should react, like that gold example. And then that's my bias. And then so I then look at the technicals for trying to time trades. And I do that through kind of mechanic setups, or like back tested setups, where we take things like momentum, trend, volatility, relative strength, put them together into a back test on something like Pine Script. And that's kind of gives me signals for when's a decent time to maybe enter this trade, and cross your fingers and hope it goes well.
Hope. Hope is not a strategy. But of course we all do use that word. And of course you do obviously hope things go well in your trading. But I mean that point that brings me actually to the next question is around risk. In listening to a number of your podcasts that you've interviewed other traders, from what I can gather, it sounds like you're quite tied to the 1% risk. Risk, in other words, one unit of risk is 1% of your capital. Is that right? Am I got that right?
It probably was right at the time.
Okay.
It's not the way I do things now, but I mean I appreciate. I mean I've changed, like I've changed quite often through the podcast, especially the earlier ones, as I met more and more traders. But yeah, I think definitely I was tied to that 1% till I met Rob Carver, and then I met Simon, and then I've changed to anywhere from 2 to 5% is my kind of risk initial position size.
Okay, that's interesting to hear, because that was going to be my next question, was to say that, do you feel that having a very small percentage of capital on the line, in a way, it's not meaningful enough in a sense that if it goes wrong, you're not losing that much money, but that might then force you to be a little bit lax or take perhaps not such great trades. And the question was going to be, would a bigger or more meaningful risk number, bigger risk unit, not focus the mind a bit more? So have you found that as you've actually increased the size of that risk unit, that it's sort of you take it a bit more seriously, I guess, because it hurts a little bit more when you get it wrong, and therefore, it means that when you before you initiate a trade, you're kind of a little bit more focused and just determined to make sure that it's likely to be a winner.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a more meaningful sum of money, but I think even if it's 1%, like, but to touch on the range, it's like it just depends a little bit on your strategy, right? If you're trading, again, intraday scalping on, S&P futures, 1% might be quite a lot of risk. But for me, just because my strategy very rarely will close out intraday, because it's based on two or three X ATR as a stop loss, so it's quite large stops. So it's unlikely, and that's why sometimes I bet more. But if my my strategy was different and I was trading intraday, then I think I would definitely be open to using something like 1% or even half a percent. It just depends, and that's why I think statistics are so important around some trades, and why I put together those back tests, is because I want to know what my average winning days in a trade is, because if it's less than one day, then I don't want to bet that 5%, but they tend to not be. And the other thing I think is, oh, I think it, I do prefer having a range because it gives some flexibility, but When I started, it wasn't because I had 1%, but it was, I think I used to not add to trades when I put on trades. So I think when you start a position, I think it's okay to have 1%. If you have a plan to then bet more percent as that trade goes in your favor, I think that's a lot, that can be more sensible than betting 10% and then just trying to hold on for dear life that it's going to go your way, right? But when people start agreeing with you in a trade, I've found good success in finding those additional timing points where I can add a unit of risk here, or we have a 20-day breakout here, which is another signal you might get, and I add one unit of risk there, or whatever. But I mean, to answer your question, I think, yeah, meaningful size kind of keep you a little bit more sharp. But I think if it's you thinking about your risk sizing, think about your strategy and think about, yeah, your process, because that's the most important thing. Because if your strategy again is a average holding period of 60 days, then 1% is going to be absolutely kind of meaningless, So until you get that understanding about yourself and your process or your strategy, then it's hard to risk size for everyone individually.
Good point that. Good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in your interview with Simon Rhee, this is one of the interviews you did that I really enjoyed, and I actually think I should try to get him onto my podcast as well. He was a great guest, probably one of your best podcasts, I thought.
Yeah.
But he actually made the point that retail traders have a number of advantages that institutional traders and hedge fund traders don't have, such as, the freedom, the flexibility to make their own decisions, not having a risk manager looking over their shoulder all the time, not having investors to answer to. So that's all very well, but I also look at that and I think, well, I think a lot of the time retail traders would actually do better if they did have to answer to somebody, because that total freedom it comes with, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? You can, you can go wild, and sometimes that doesn't work out. I mean, what is your view on that?
Yeah, I think again, when you're starting off, the last thing you want is the freedom. I think I get Simon's point of what he's trying to say, but I think if I think back to my own start, it's like what I'm, you're long, 30% of your account into a FOMC meeting, and you're like, you shouldn't be doing that, right? So I think the you have to account for the kind of to not offend anyone, the column stupidity type tax of a new trader, right? Because when I started, it was like no concept of position sizing, and even if I did, your capital is so small, the chances you'll be interested in trading that capital on that size is zero to none, right? Because if you think about when people start, they're undercapitalized and they want to make money. So very hard to make money when you're undercapitalized. It's very hard to make money in general. But when you're undercapitalized, it just means you're going to bet bigger. So I think, yeah, having someone that knows what good looks like in terms of risk management on your shoulder would save people a lot of money. But I think as you go on, I think one point Simon made, which I think is important, is as a retail trader, it's okay to sit on the sideline. It's okay to not do anything. Like if I think back to my own trading this month, like two trades this month, most of them was running one trade, which is something I've come to appreciate is not easy at all. I think it's much easier to take a loss than to run a trade personally. But I felt that, say, for example, in FX, that there wasn't that much going on. Like the euro dollar move kind of happened. We're kind of consolidating there for the last week or so. I don't need to be in and out of a day trade to try and nick 30 pips on euro dollar. I can just sit there and keep my money, because people forget when you're sitting in cash or you're sitting flat and you've no open positions, you can't lose any money. But when you're taking a trade for no apparent reason, or it's not through your process, or I haven't got my bias and my timing and my entry and my volatility stops and my trailing, all this kind of stuff, you can lose that money. You know, as in, it's not even in your process. You're just taking it for the sake of it. So at that point, I agree with. But overall, yeah, people would save a fortune if they had a risk manager at
Yeah, they would.
the
They would. But it's
start.
interesting what you say there. Yeah, cash is a position, and cash gives you optionality. And quite right. I think it's one of the harder things is to actually sit on your hands and do nothing because the market is always moving. There's always perceived that there's this perception that there's always opportunities out there because things are moving around, but they're not necessarily high probability opportunities. So it's intrigued to hear what you said there. But likewise, I mean, that's also something I've found over my years in the market is you kind of learn that it's okay to sit on your hands, and often that actually it's the best thing you can do.
Yeah, and on that point on volatility and things that are happening now, you know, someone had said to me before about trading, or they knew I was interested in, they said, you know, volatility is opportunity. And I know Kent Bray also said that to me. And people think that just because there's volatility, you should be making money as a trader. But that phrase is used by investment bank traders that have flow and they're making spreads on client flows. That's, and the spreads are wider because the volatility is bigger. It's not because, you know, just because things are falling off a cliff, you should be up 200%. So I think that's also something I think people need to just realize is not a true belief as a retail trader just because it's volatile. I would say if it's volatile, it's a good opportunity to come up, pre-plan a setup or a technical setup that can take advantage of volatility. You could use options, you could use lots of different ways to do that. So next time there's volatility, maybe you can make money on it. But just because, to be honest, you're more likely to lose, or in my experience, I've lost more money in volatile times than non-volatile times.
Well, this is it. Yeah, a lot of people say to me, and say, "Well, I'm a trader." They say, "Oh, well," and there's been a lot of volatility, like lately, with the tariffs and Trump and all of the world's in a bit of a tumultuous state at the moment. And everyone's like, "Oh, you must be making tons of money. There's so much volatility." And you're like, "Well, it cuts both ways. Yes, there's lots of volatility, and yes, there's money to be made. There's also a lot of money to be lost if you are on the wrong side of it." So for me, it's like there's a sort of an ideal amount of volatility that I like, but too much volatility is kind of scary.
And it should mean wider stops for people that that are taking into account volatility of an instrument or recent volatility, or if it's ATR or whatever they use. But a lot of the time people just ignore that and they set the same stop they would otherwise, and you're like, well, that just doesn't make any sense. But that's the stuff you do when you're new, I guess.
Yes, exactly. We learn as we go.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you like to add to winners, which is a very good practice. Cut losers quickly and add to winners. But you also mentioned that running a trade and holding on to winners is tough, and that's certainly something I've also found. I think I actually think the hardest part of trading is knowing when to sell. Finding a good entry, you can do that. Executing a stop loss, easy enough. But knowing the right time to sell, now that's challenging. So, with that in mind, have you got some figures in terms of your own stats, in like things like how long you hold on to a winning trade versus how long you hold on to a losing trade?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the strategy, but say short-term trend following could be, you know, 5 to 10 days in a winning, well, is what I say, but 10 to 15 days in a winning trade, maybe 2 to about 8 days in a losing trade. But it tends to be, yeah, when I have kind of taken average days in the trade for a strategy, just it's not that I'm expecting it to be that in this trade, because you know, the last thing I want to do is paint what I have in my head or what happened in a back test in front of a chart in front of me, because I don't know what's going to happen in that chart, right? I
Of
just
course.
it's just giving me some indication that maybe this would be, you know, 15-ish days. But I mean, I'd like to trail those positions with trailing volatility stops, and that for me is the ideal setup. Is because, you know, when you're trying to set profit targets, I've always found that, and I've my last guest on the show had some kind of, I can't remember the phrase, but essentially it's like you're telling the market, you know, it should stop there, and really you shouldn't be telling the market anything. So a trailing volatility stop can always give yourself the kind of or have the humility to know I don't need to know exactly where this is going to stop, right? It's like I'm just going to follow it. And then when the market tells me it's stopping and closes me out, then it's stopping. Or if you want to go full Richard Dennis and you have a an opposite trade set up to go short when something happens, like a break of a prior 20-day bar low, you're in short, and then the vice versa, you're long, etc. You can do that too. But I have statistics to give me an idea, but I also like to use trailing stops because I accept that I don't know
No,
what's
of
going to
course.
happen. If it rips, it's great. You know what I mean? But also, like, I think I don't want to waffle, but I will just add from even today, you know, I had no reason to close a position today, but I was kind of P&L watching a position that I'd run for 20 for 25 days or something. I've been in this Bitcoin position, best position I've ever been in, right, to date. A really, really good trade, added to it, time points, etc. And I had absolutely no reason to close it today, bar the P&L. I thought it was great. So I was kind of like lots of things going on early in the morning, and I'm like, do I keep it open? Do I not? So yeah, I talk a big game, Gareth, about, you know, trailing stops and da-da-da, but even at that, I still close positions when I know this average days holding and statistics and all that. So just because I'm can be a little bit human, so I'm working on it.
We're all human. We all have
Yeah.
emotions, and you're very honest about that, and I appreciate it. You've interviewed a number of traders on your podcast, as I mentioned, and you've actually interviewed some quite big names as well, which is really, really excellent. So I wanted to ask you from the interviews that you've done with some of these successful traders, if you had to pick out one or two takeaways that you think are consistent among all of them. I mean, I appreciate most traders have a different style or different strategy, but are there some consistent things that you've noticed that the traders, successful traders, all kind of have in common?
Yeah, I think they don't predict. It's one big thing I've noticed about best traders I've interviewed. None of them try and predict the future. None of them make forecasts, economic forecasts. They all accept that you know, what's going on Bloomberg in the news is this massive charade of market participants with headline statements about the future, none of which you know to be true, right? But best traders I've met have, over sometimes decades of failing, created a process that works for them, that creates an edge. And that process has things like, you know, price action, has things like fundamental analysis, combines the two. Usually it's not fundamental analysis on its own, but there is some elements of that, or it could be stock analysis for people that use trade small caps. Yeah, so that's one big thing. And the other thing is they're real tape watchers, right? They focus more on price action than they focus on anything else. And that has been a big key for me as someone, as I said, I don't know if we were recording or not, but I big time fell in love with the world of macro and geopolitics and policy and you name it. If it was on the news, central bank speak, rates, I was all over it, you know. And I found a mentor that was also all over it, and I was like, "Oh, I found it! Now this is my calling." But over time and even working with that mentor, it's again, it's the world of macro is so ungrounded. It's like talking about every risk that could happen ever. I've found that idea of focusing on price action, no one knows more than the tape. When you combine that with the context of what's going on in the world and geopolitics, for me, that's where I mentioned I get my bias from. So it's like, you know, if things are happening in the world of macro, they have a traditional impact, you know, economic policy that's pro-growth, it's pro-USD and pro-US interest rates. That means nothing unless USD and interest rates are both going up in that scenario. If they're not, I think it can be very interesting as to why they're not. Now, like Jason Shapiro, for example, talks about positioning, and he has the COT data that he uses with that to get an idea of positioning. I don't go that far, especially in FX, because part of me kind of doesn't, I don't really need to question why something has or hasn't happened, or need to know if they're it's overpositioned in futures data, which may not be the full picture either, I think. And it's not an FX. Just the market reaction along with the context for me is enough to say that's something, you know. And I give an example. I was on a podcast with Jason Senn not so long ago, probably 3 weeks ago, and it was on the first bounce in equities post Liberation Day, right?
Right.
So if equities fall off a cliff,
Yeah.
then they bounce and kind of hang around for a couple of days. And on the Wednesday, we had so backdrop is US recession risk,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Blinking red letters, right? Everyone now, I read this morning, is 40% of earnings reports, CEOs were predicting a US recession the second half of this year. All
Yeah.
this kind of talk, right? And it's not that I believe that. I don't really care. I mean, I'm human, but I don't care too much about the prediction.
Right.
But in that example, right, we have core durables comes out that day, which is tier one data in the US. It beats expectations on core and headline durables, and directly after that, equity starts to fall, right? So
Yeah.
for me, that's a lot more significant than, oh, we reverted to the mean and then we're catching the bounce in the trend. And, it means something,
Yeah.
because there's a direct reaction. Because I think price can be so random sometimes, and people don't appreciate that it can be quite random. And trying to find the signal in the noise, I find those data releases plus the context can give you a something that actually means something, something to hang your P&L on, you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We're coming towards the end of our time, so I think I've got two more questions really for you. But something I've learned over the years as a trader is it's a grind, and you've actually just got to learn to love the grind. And by that I mean, doing the homework, doing reading the charts, reading the news, listening to the, fundamental information, watching other technical analysts, and listening to their views, and maybe getting ideas. It's a grind. And in a sense, part of what I like about it, I suppose, it feels like digging for diamonds. If you're not digging, you're not going to find anything. But if you are digging, you'll find some diamonds, and every now and again, you're going to find a big diamond. I mean, I wanted to ask, do you agree with that in your process? And are there any shortcuts to success in this business, do you think?
I think I definitely agree. It's a grind, and you have to work hard at it. I think if you don't like it and you're forcing yourself to work hard at it, I don't think you'll last very long. I think there has to be a little bit of a combination of an interest plus hard work, because hard work is like it's the minimum. As you said, you have to do the work to get, somewhere semi-meaningful. But if you're not interested, you're not going to do the work, and the work you do is going to be kind of semi, I don't know, I just think it's because it takes a little bit more than hard work. Then on top of that, it's the interest. It's also, I find my looking for trades and that process as being a little bit creative too. As you said, you learn from other people. You go looking in articles about how do the market wizards do it? How does, how can I look at different concepts and bring it into my own process? For me, that's working hard, but it's also having an open mind. It's being interested. It's being curious. All that has to come together for me, for someone to find their own kind of way. So yeah, I think hard work is the minimum you need to start getting somewhere. But I think once you do, and the other part of that is that consistency. So I know you said the word grind. It's yeah, in that I take the word consistency in there as well. It's like you can't just do it one evening. This is like markets are open 5 days a week or seven if you trade crypto, right? So it's like it's going to open on Monday. Are you going to be ready for when it opens on Monday or not? Or are you going to be behind? So that's the grind, I think. But also, I don't want to present it like, we're all US military either, right? It's like I think it's something that is extremely fascinating. It's a world that you may never see again, right? This kind of political regime shift that's happening at the moment is like the highest tariffs in history. I think you could fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure it's higher than some graph I saw than back in the 30s or whenever, right?
Yeah, back
It's
in
a
the First World War, sort of similar. In fact, I think it is higher, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, and it's you've got Europe's major pivot now, huge fiscal spend. You've got that has asset implications. It's like for me, it's just a amazing time to be involved in it. You know, there's so much going on. So, I kind of, I don't. I think when you're new, you should grind at it. But I think over time, as you get into it, it just becomes the kind of like the air you breathe. It's not like I'm working hard trying to put together a new strategy. I just think it would be really helpful and it's kind of cool. And maybe I sound like a nerd there as well, right? But I think it's that's an important part of it as well.
It is. I think having a passion for it and actually wanting to do that grind, learning to love the grind is so key to the success.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
All right. So I think we're pretty much out of time. The last thing I wanted to ask is where listeners to this podcast can see you. I mean, obviously we're going to give your podcast a plug. Unpacking the Markets. It's on YouTube. Where else can users get hold of you or see your work and your content?
It's on YouTube mainly. I think I'm neglecting Spotify a little bit at the moment. So, up to date is on YouTube, Spotify, and I post a bit on LinkedIn. So if you find me, just search my name on LinkedIn. Those are the main ones. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. Colm, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for your time. And I know we're going to catch up for a beer in London in a week or two's time. So looking forward to that as well.
100%. It was a real pleasure, Gareth. Thank you for having me on.
Great pleasure. Take care. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Talking with Traders, sponsored by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a strong global provider of online trading services as our backer for this podcast series. Remember to subscribe for more episodes by clicking on the subscribe button of your favorite podcast app. Or if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, and leave a comment. We welcome the engagement. Till next time.